නමෝ තස්සා භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්සා භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්සා භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස බුද්ධං ධම්මං සංඝං නමස්සාමි. So I hope you're mellowing out. Rather than freaking out. You need a lot of trust and patience to do this kind of work. Just trust that non-grasping, awareness of change is effective. It seems so very ordinary when you begin, so what? But in that attitude of, it's actually a very, I think the attitude of meditation is rather like, I was looking out my window, I'm on the third floor, and there's someone loading the red car, not one of our group, someone else. And they're unloading everything from the trunk, putting in the front seat and doing something. Looked a bit weird. I was just observing. And then someone came with a bicycle and put the bicycle in the back of the hatchback, is that what you call them? So that's not going to go in there. It went in there. I was observing my state of observing. You get very observant, don't you? And just the kind of relaxed nature of that undemanding, no agenda, no goal, just what is it, what's going on right now? And it's actually kind of what we're trying to do in observing the way things are. Or the analogy I like is when I travel to Asia now, every now and then someone shouts me a business class ticket. Ooh! It's a pretty punishing journey. I go to Asia every year, so to have that sense of being able to be relaxed, and so I go in with my business class ticket. And it's interesting watching my mind. I start to think I deserve it. And then the people in the back there, I think, oh, those people. I'm a privileged being. Interesting. Anyway, but just sitting in a lounge I've gotten through the hassle of the customs or whatever you have to go through, and then they search you and do all that business, and then so I'm just sitting in a lounge waiting. There's an hour to go or something. I know it's going to be comfortable. I just observe people coming and going. It's quite fun, isn't it? People watching. No stress, and nothing to do. And that's kind of the attitude we're trying to bring to our attentiveness. But it's not so easy because it's not neutral, because the body feels pain, we feel frustrated, we're trapped 45 minutes, can't go around, move around, so it's a different situation. But that would be I would think that would be the attitude to try to cultivate, this observing of the way things are. But it's very hard to do that, because whenever we observe things, we usually want a result. We want to find something. And so like on this batik here, there's one Buddha which is significantly different. Significantly different. Now most of you will come and now look at that Buddha. And you'll try to find which is the one that's significantly different. And if you're curious at all, you're going to do it. And that's a certain kind of looking. You're looking for something. And that's usually what we do when we have a problem to solve. We're looking for something. But our I think ultimately the observation or awareness that we are cultivating is not so much intended to find an object, but it's realizing that the very awareness is our refuge. So we we use, like we say, mindfulness with the breath. So it's not so much about the breath, it's just that we attend to something in the moment that is natural, that is always here now, and by attending to that we emphasize awareness. So whether your breath is shorter or long or whatever, can use that to attend to that. Or we use the sound of silence, the kind of background zinging sound which seems to be there all the time, and we use that, which points to awareness. So we're always pointing to the awareness, because awareness is the awareness of change, or awareness and clear understanding. Sati sampajanya is the place of peace and the place of refuge. But to do that, it's hard when there is pain, and so desire comes up. When there's memory, when there are just habits, the habits of fantasizing and planning and organizing and complaining, so we come up against our karma, or the vipaka karma, the resultant karma of the way we've been conditioned by society, the way we've reacted and responded and all the rest of it. And so it's not so simple, not so straightforward. But I find if I just do simple things like that and get that sense of what awareness is like, then I know I'm always on track. And then the problem becomes my attraction or repulsion or basically the attachment to the sense experience that comes. So like in the sitting before tea, yeah, my knees are giving me problems, and so I usually just sit through it, so it's not that bad. This time I didn't want to, so I shifted the posture and I used this red cushion on my left knee. It's getting kind of geriatric in my... I'll have probably a pile of cushions at the end of the retreat. Yeah. So, and then I just noticed that felt uncomfortable. It wasn't painful, it was just different. And so the desire mind would like the sense experience to be comfortable. So I'm used to a certain posture now, the posture's a bit wonky. It wasn't painful, so I just observed. I tried to observe just the sense of discomfort or strangeness in posture. And as I observed it, the strangeness became normal and my mind was peaceful. And that is it's a simple exercise, but that's going on all the time. And what that does then, it starts to develop a capacity in your makeup, in your character, that can be with all manner of just uncomfortable things, because the stress is no longer, the attention is no longer about the uncomfortable thing itself, not the particular, but the way to be with that in a peaceful, non-conflicted way. So simple exercises like that, I think, do have a profound effect. They begin to inform your whole being about how to be with life with all its changes. And this is a refuge we can all understand and practice. It's a training. I mentioned the idea of a perception as opposed to belief. And that's, for me, a very important part of the capacity I have to observe. So, like, just take Ajahn Chah's, if you have read any of Ajahn Chah's published talks in English, you'll see that he was always stressing uncertainty. So, anicca sanya, or the perception of change, he would use the Thai word mine, and constantly just go, it's uncertain. He wasn't asking us to believe something, because that's quite easy. You know, someone has a car accident, we all kind of shake our Buddhist heads and say, yes, life is uncertain. You know, big deal. And you end up being this kind of cliche Buddhist, right? Oh, yeah, life is uncertain, yes. Yeah, she died, yes, uncertain. But that's actually, you know, that's more like a belief or a cultural position that we take. It's not wrong. But the vitality of the contemplative life is much more demanding, I suppose, much more. Well, you have to recollect, don't you? You have to remember. So Ajahn Chah's recommendation to constantly notice perceptions, bodily feelings, social situations, mental formations, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, all the rest of it to see is uncertain. Now that takes that's a practice that you have to do. So it's a perception that you're doing all the time, rather than a fixed perception. It's just like the glass half full, half empty. I can feel very down on my luck, and then I change my perception. Yeah, but the glass is still half full, right? So it's a perception I can enliven, as opposed to just being a cliche, which people use all the time. So I think that's important, not to just leave Buddhism as a set of beliefs or disbeliefs or confusions, but rather make it alive in that way. So the in the end of the sutta, Anya Kundanya, Kundanya knows. You know? That's an interesting conclusion to that sutta, isn't it? He knows that which has a nature to arise is a nature to cease. Now, if that were just this sort of simplistic, the weather's changing, that if it was just that, it wouldn't be an enlightenment statement. But obviously something more deep, and there's something about the sustained contemplation of anicca, the kind of sense of uncertainty, which illuminates the profundity of awareness, rather than pointing always to the object, it points to awareness itself. And then there are depths of that realization, depths of that understanding. So in terms of perceptions, also the perception that the teaching asks us to consider is, we'll probably chant this one in English too, it's the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And the three suttas in this book we consider the three cardinal suttas. So there's the Fire Sermon, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and the Dhammacakka Sutta. And the Anatta Lakkhana is a characteristic. Lakkhana is characteristic. I said yesterday, Dukkha Lakkhana. And this is Anatta Lakkhana. And the refrain you find in this sutta, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. And that's around Anatta. And so the monks are asked to do this. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. Now, to apply that to your emotions, to your car, or whatever, to constantly apply that, what effect might that have? Well, you don't know until you do it. You don't know. But it would require you actually making, seeing that as significant in the teaching, seeing it as interesting, maybe, and wanting to do it, wanting to apply that. And then, like reading the sutta maybe every morning, every day, and then beginning to really recollect that, and then applying it to all your activities. And one does that quietly. It's not like, you say to your mate, every morning at breakfast you say that to them, and well, shut up, you dumb Buddhist, it's just a very kind of personal thing. It's almost nonverbal after a while. It just becomes a perception, and the words help you to see that way. So what would the effect of that be? What would be the effect if you took that set of perceptions? What would be the effect if you took the perception of anicca? Well, you don't know, but the contemplative life is saying, well, you have to give it a go, and see how it affects you. And it would affect you powerfully. And then the third perception is the perception of unsatisfactoriness. And I talked about that yesterday. So this is unsatisfactory. This is unsatisfactory, which isn't a put down. Again, it's just a perspective. What would that do? And all three of those perceptions, again, they highlight what awareness is about. They kind of point to awareness itself. Whereas the other, this is me and this is mine, or whoopee, this is great, this is going to be great, or whatever, it always points to the object. And then the object always sort of tends to disappoint us. So the use of perceptions then, I think, is a really important understanding in Buddhism. How do you use perceptions? So the teachings on anatta, people are always trying to figure them out as positions, philosophical positions. So some people misapprehend Buddhism, say, there is no self. There's no self. Well, what the heck does that mean? Mm-hmm. I'm still here. Kick me in the shins and I feel it. You don't, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so. And so it's just the kind of, and then you get into an argument. You say, there's no, there isn't. What's the point of that, too? But as a perception, so I see I'm getting upset with someone, and I say, this is not mine, this is not myself, I'm not this. Whatever way you want to say that. That puts a different perspective on it. Or, this is uncertain. Or this is unsatisfactory. Puts a perspective on it. And that perspective was the one of awareness. Awareness of change. Of non-attachment, non-grasping. And so this is the third of... This is the way we use intellect, but go beyond thought. Because just to think about these things, this is... You can read essays and essays on this, but how many times do you have to read the essay on that? On how many times have we read about a Nietzsche? And so it's not that complicated. So that's one thing I wanted to just sort of encourage in the way you practice. Which one to do? Doesn't really matter. But to bring perceptions which are Dhamma. So we say that when there's a part in the teaching where someone is in the text where a monk becomes totally intoxicated with the beauty of the Buddha. So apparently the Buddha was a very beautiful person just physically. You imagine his radiance and charisma must have been very powerful. And the Buddha says, this is just a bag of bones. It's not about that. It's about the Dhamma. So when you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. When you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. And so that is that way. When our perceptions are in line with the Dhamma, we see the Dhamma of change. And that's nature. It's not doctrine. I mean, it is doctrinal, I suppose, but it's not like dogma of some sorts. Anyone can apprehend that. And when we begin to interpret life in that way, notice life that way, perceive life that way, then we are Buddha practicing Dhamma. We're taking refuge, or Buddha knowing Dhamma. So Ajahn Sumedho often would say, I don't know if he says this anymore in his early talks at Chitters, he say, what do Buddhas know that others don't know? That which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease, is not self. It doesn't sound like much. But actually, you do it. It really has a profound effect on your mind. Thing is, we forget, don't we? You know, we take it all personally. So, I recommend that book that Ajahn Sumedho's, Don't Take Your Life Personally. I mean, that's such a great title, isn't it? I recommend that book to so many people. I should get a cut in the action, but it's such a brilliant title. Don't Take Your Life Personally. So, I would suggest like if you read something like these three suttas. And see if you can take some of the perceptions that are encouraged in that. And notice how we've read this sutta now together twice over. Interesting how it affects you, doesn't it? It's not like reading, okay, I got that, where's the next one? It's not about accumulating information. It's more stimulating recollection. And that's very important to always have some kind of recollection in your life of the Dhamma. So you're always functioning from right understanding. It is a wisdom teaching. And I also want to mention just the difference between method and goal. And that's one of the things I've been emphasizing last few years, but I remember way, way back in early days in New Zealand where I was listening to a talk of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's, and he said that compassion was a method. And it really struck me. Oh, yeah. Because before that, I thought compassion was the goal. And then when I wasn't compassionate, which was a lot of the time, I felt, you know, gosh, I must be compassionate. And we do that to ourselves. We go into the kind of shoulds and shouldn't be's, right? I should be compassionate, and I shouldn't do this, and I should do that. And I sometimes people like who have never met a monk before, and they come to the monastery, and they're surprised that we're humans. You know, that we kind of fart around and joke around and make cynical comments about life and take too many cakes and do all manner of monk-like things. Oh, you shouldn't be like that. But I think actually they're relieved. But that, you know, any kind of high moral religious philosophy can be this constant position taking. I shouldn't be like this, I should be like that, I should be more compassionate, which is just more self-view, isn't it? And that's not the teaching at all. So compassion is the method. Now that's a bit more interesting, or kindness is the method, or generosity is the method, or patience is the method, or determination is the method, or concentration is the method. This becomes much more possible as it's something that you develop and that you cultivate. So say generosity is the method. You can see how when the heart is genuinely generous, it's less greedy. It has more joy. It doesn't have to hold on to stuff. It wants to share. You know, it has a lot of energy. So you could see generosity, yeah. Generosity makes me much more mindful. It's much easier to be mindful when I'm happy. There's vitality in the mind. Right? Generosity can go off, or I'm always just planning to do things. Another great thing that I want to do from generosity. But as a method, as opposed to a goal. So if I say to myself, "Oh, I'm not generous enough. I should be more generous," that's a put down, based in self view. That's not dharma. But to feel the sense of being stingy, say, "I'm not going to share my mango with Kema. No way. My mango is bigger than your mango," and to what? And to actually observe that sense of, I don't want to share, as a dharma. This is not me, this is not mine, this is uncertain. And yet, make choices towards that which is conducive to enlightenment. So the method is to not choose stinginess, but to choose generosity. But it's not coming from idealism, it's coming from pragmatism, it's coming from, yeah. The method would be, yeah, if I could be more generous, that would be a good thing. And so I start to motivate myself to move in that direction. Method. But to think that I should be generous, what do I do when I'm not generous? When I'm just bloody-minded, I'm tired, I have the flu, and you get out of my life, leave me alone. Is that so wrong? No, there's nothing wrong with that. This is human. I should be more compassionate, as opposed to, oh yeah, compassion, it really helps me with cruelty. And might say if I have a cruel sense of humor, you know, I kind of set people up and then knock them down, or I gossip in a cruel way about other people behind their backs. I set other people up to look bad in the eyes of a third person and so on and so forth. I say, well, that's cruel. And then I feel the impulse of cruelty, and I see that just obsesses me with people and scenarios, and I see that attachment. What could I do with that? Well, compassion. And then I think, oh, compassion, okay. So then when I start to think about some person in a destructive way, then maybe I shift. I say, yeah, there's that perception, but they also suffer. They also try to be happy. I shift my perception, and that's a very freeing perception, isn't it? It liberates the heart. There's no residue, whereas if I'm cruel, there's a lot of residue. Patience is part of the method. So we were talking in the car, just one, someone was saying in the car that they understood they were going through some difficulty, and they said, had this insight, oh, I'm practicing endurance. Ah. Rather than you, I have to endure as some monolithic chunk of personality you have to be. Rather, no, I can practice endurance. That's a method. Rather than I should be able to endure, should be. So do look at that. Do look at the tendencies to self-flagellate and go to that perspective as opposed to training the mind. Then you can, you're always inclining towards that which is really balanced. And if you understand what balance is, just this simple piece of listening to the way things are, and you have faith in that, then you'll see what obsesses you. And you'll see where your attention gets caught up with the khandhas in some way, or some your own personal history, or some bodily formations that you have to endure, or some social situation which always presses your buttons or whatever. And you'll say, okay, that, how can I practice non-grasping in that situation? What do I need to do? What kind of factors, what methodology could I use? So I think those two things are very important, the sense of method as opposed to goal. And there is a goal. You know, there is a goal. There is liberation from suffering. But the method is to create the foundation, to create the right factors, and the rest will take care of itself. So that, I think, is important. And then the use of perception as opposed to just functioning from trite, cliched Buddhist beliefs. Do you find that boring when yet another Buddhist cliche comes up from someone? Oh God, don't. Again. And I want to just say, no, it's permanent. You're going to be afraid now to say it's impermanent to me. But take it beyond that, right? Take it beyond. I mean, those are good words. They're good words to use in a Buddhist culture. But take it deeper to really using these perceptions, because they are the pathway of liberation. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.
Andamayang dhamma kataya sadhukarang dadamase sadhu sadhu.